Blog Talk Radio.
This is the News in Brief from the United Nations. No less than 55 countries today are struggling with serious health worker shortages as they continue to seek better paid opportunities in wealthier nations that have stepped up efforts to recruit them amid the COVID-19 pandemic, the World Health Organization, WHO, said on Tuesday. According to the UN agency, African nations have been worst hit by the phenomenon, with 37 countries on the continent facing health worker shortages that threaten their chances of achieving universal healthcare by 2030, a key sustainable development goals pledge. The actions of wealthy countries that belong to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, or OECD, come under scrutiny in the WHO alert, among other regions. With more, here's Dr. Jim Campbell, director of WHO's health workforce team.
Within Africa, it's a very vibrant economy that's creating new opportunities. The Gulf states have traditionally been reliant on international personnel. And then some of the OECD high-income countries have really accelerated their recruitment and employment to respond to the pandemic and respond to the loss of lives, the infections, the absences of workers during the pandemic.
To help countries protect their vulnerable healthcare systems, the UN Health Agency has issued an updated health workforce support and safeguards list, which highlights nations with low numbers of qualified staff. Mechanisms also exist for governments or other individuals to notify WHO if they're worried about the behavior of recruiters. More than 1 in 2 Syrians is food insecure, and a further 2.9 million risk sliding into hunger, UN humanitarians warned on Tuesday. In an alert, the World Food Programme, WFP, also warned that malnutrition is on the rise in Syria, with stunting and maternal malnutrition rates reaching levels never seen before. Ken Crossley, WFP country director in Syria, said that in 12 years of war, the Syrian people had suffered bombardment, displacement, isolation, drought, economic meltdown, and now earthquakes of staggering proportions. Syrians remain remarkably resilient, but there's only so much that people can take, Mr. Crossley warned, just as a funding crunch threatens to curtail WFP's work. To keep aid flowing, the UN agency urgently requires a minimum of $450 million to help more than 5.5 million people across Syria until the end of the year. To Afghanistan, where displaced communities and the neighboring countries that have taken them in need help urgently, many of them women and children, the UN refugee agency UNHCR has said. In an appeal to support 7.9 million people in Afghanistan and the region, UNHCR issued a request on Tuesday for $613 million. This will cover the basic requirements of Afghans sheltering in Iran, Pakistan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan. These countries host a total of 8.2 million Afghans, including over 2 million registered refugees. Many have been in the region for decades, mostly in Iran and Pakistan, which the UN agency explained had accommodated Afghans generously, offering them access to public services at great cost. An estimated 1.6 million have arrived in the region from Afghanistan since 2021. Financial support remains critical to stave off widespread hunger, disease, malnutrition, and ultimately death, UNHCR said. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Coming up in the second hour following the latest radio eco shock.
When feminist theologian Rifat Hassan said anti-woman writing was added later by companions of the Prophet, doors were slammed.
The Quran, on the basis of my years of study, guarantees human freedom and equality. Up till this point, it has not been possible to raise any critical question about the companions of the Prophet. It's a capital crime.
On the next broadcast of TUC Radio.
And that will be in the second hour following Radio EcoShock. And now the latest this morning's headlines from Democracy Now!
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Russian fighter jets intercepted a U.S. drone over the Black Sea Tuesday, leading the operators of the MQ-9 Reaper drone to bring it down in international waters. The U.S. military says it downed the drone after its propeller was struck by a Russian jet. Russia denies making contact with the drone, which it said was gathering intelligence to help Ukraine attack Russia, and said it had entered a prohibited area near Crimea. If a collision is confirmed, it would be the first known contact between the U.S. and Russian military since the start of the Ukraine war. We'll have more on the implications of this, as well as the latest reports on the Nord Stream pipeline blow-up, after headlines with The Intercept's Jeremy Scahill. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren introduced a bill to repeal the Trump-era rollback of the Dodd-Frank Act following the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank. The bill brings the threshold for banks that must undergo extra federal regulations back down to at least $50 billion in assets. The limit was raised to $250 billion in 2018 after lobbying by the banking industry, including SVB, which held around $209 billion in assets. This is Senator Warren speaking Tuesday.
The federal government, once again, was called on to take extraordinary measures, the kind of measures that Dodd-Frank was originally supposed to protect us against. These threats should never have been allowed to materialize, and now we must prevent them from occurring again.
California Congressmember and Senator hopeful Katie Porter unveiled a similar bill in the House. This comes as reports emerged the Justice Department and Securities and Exchange Commission opened investigations into the collapse of SVB. The Environmental Protection Agency has proposed new rules to force water companies to remove what's known as forever chemicals, or PFAS, from drinking water. The man-made chemicals, which have been linked to cancer, infertility, thyroid problems, have also been detected in many common household products, including cosmetics and food packaging. Environmental groups welcome the move, but push for stronger regulations against the all-around use of PFAS and to force chemical companies to pay for their pollution. President Biden issued an executive order offering modest improvements on gun control, including increasing background checks. Biden announced the new measures Tuesday while visiting California's Monterey Park, where a gunman killed 11 people in January at a dance studio during Lunar New Year celebrations.
My executive order directs my attorney general to take every lawful action possible to move us as close as we can to universal background checks without new legislation. It's just common sense to check whether someone is a felon, a domestic abuser, before they buy a gun. The executive order also expands public awareness campaigns about the red flag orders.
Biden also called again on Congress to pass more robust gun control legislation, including an assault weapons ban. A Pakistan court has ordered police to halt its arrest operation against former Prime Minister Imran Khan until Thursday morning. It was the second attempt to arrest him this month. On Tuesday, hundreds of Khan supporters gathered outside his residence in Lahore, blocking security forces. Riot police fired a water cannon and tear gas to disperse protesters in an hours-long standoff that ended earlier today after authorities finally withdrew from outside Khan's home. Imran Khan is accused of corruption and terrorism, charges he's denied and denounced as politically motivated. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is meeting with Ethiopian leaders today in Addis Ababa, including Tigrayan officials, 4 months after a peace deal was reached last November following 2 years of brutal war. Blinken will then travel to Niger Thursday in the first visit to the West African nation by a sitting U.S. Secretary of State. In southeastern Africa, the death toll from Cyclone Freddy more than doubled in one day, jumping to 220 Tuesday across Malawi, Mozambique, and Madagascar, with hundreds more injured and scores missing. Cyclone Freddy is the longest-lasting tropical cyclone on record. Survivors in Malawi, which suffered the highest death toll, described harrowing scenes and heroic rescues.
The child was stuck up to her head in the mud. She was crying for help. Even though the water was very strong, we managed to cross and rescue her. It was very difficult, but we managed to pull her out.
Back in the United States, Novo Nordisk announced it's lowering the cost of insulin by up to 70%. This follows a similar move by drug competitor Eli Lilly earlier this month and comes after years of pressure from activists, lawmakers, and people with diabetes. It also puts pressure on Sanofi, the other major insulin manufacturer in the United States, to follow suit. Last week, Congressmember Cori Bush and Senator Bernie Sanders introduced the Insulin for All Act to cap insulin prices at $20 per vial. in Massachusetts. Students at Wellesley College have approved a non-binding referendum calling for the school to accept admissions applications from non-binary and transgender students. Currently, the college only admits students who identify as women. The referendum also asks that the college's communications use gender-neutral language and pronouns. The proposals still have to be approved by the college's Board of Trustees. Ohio is suing Norfolk Southern over last month's train derailment, which spewed toxic chemicals over the town of East Palestine. The 58-count lawsuit refers to multiple violations of state and federal law. Ohio is seeking damages, civil penalties, and a, quote, declaratory judgment that Norfolk Southern is responsible. This is Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost.
Among the things we note in the complaint are Norfolk and Southern's escalating accident rate. It's up 80% over 10 years, and that's a concerning number. At least 20 Norfolk and Southern derailments since 2015 have included chemical spills.
Meta, the parent company of Facebook and Instagram, is laying off another 10,000 workers and imposing a hiring freeze on another 5,000 open positions. This comes less than 6 months after the social media giant cut 11,000 jobs last November. Another wave of layoffs and restructuring at Meta are also expected in April. In a victory for Uber and Lyft, a California court has upheld Proposition 22, allowing the companies to keep classifying ride, hail, and delivery drivers as independent contractors rather than as employees, depriving them of basic wage and labor protections. David Huerta, president of SEIU California, said in a statement, quote, when gig companies can spend over $200 million to pass a law that violates our state's constitution instead of investing in workers, it's clear California needs better safeguards for our democracy, he said. The ruling's expected to be appealed at the California Supreme Court. Illinois has become the third U.S. state to enact a law requiring employers to provide up to 40 hours of paid time off a year for workers to use for any reason. Governor J.B. Pritzker signed the law Monday, joining Maine and Nevada. It goes into effect January 2024. And pioneering former Congress member and feminist Patricia Schroeder has died at the age of 82. She was elected as the first woman to represent Colorado in the U.S. House in 1973 and served for nearly a quarter of a century. She championed women and workers' rights, access to health care, and environmental protection. She led the fight to pass the 1993 Family and Medical Leave Act, which guarantees workers up to 12 weeks of unpaid leave. As the first woman on the Armed Services Committee, Schroeder called for arms control and reduced military spending. She faced unrelenting misogyny throughout her career, but used her public platform to call it out and encourage other women to run for office. This is Pat Schroeder speaking on the House floor in 1992 in favor of the passage of the Freedom of Choice Act, which would have codified Roe v. Wade.
Especially as we are looking more and more towards national health care, we cannot have a national health care that does not recognize women equally. Otherwise, we'll be forcing all women into secondary class citizens. And I certainly hope that the Right to Choose bill gets a majority of this body, we pass it out of here, and we say to America's women, indeed, they are going to be treated equally.
That was former Colorado Congressmember Pat Schroeder. She died Monday at the age of 82. She served in Congress for more than a quarter of a century.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Two bright minds in difficult times with tools to cope. Thomas Homer Dixon and Yogi Henlin coming right at you on Radio EcoShock.
So many extreme events coming on at one time. Another atmospheric river, probably the largest yet, is hitting California as this broadcast goes out. Parts of Greenland were 50 degrees Fahrenheit hotter than normal. One Greenland town went to almost 60 degrees Fahrenheit, over 15 degrees C, in a daytime high. In early March, in the Arctic, that's ridiculous, impossible. The average high temperature for the capital city of Greenland is minus 5.1 C, or 22.8 Fahrenheit. Antarctic sea ice is at a record low. I have a guest coming up on that in a couple of weeks. But quickly, Here is the story that never made it to mainstream news the way it deserved, a hurricane that lasted over a month. In his 1994 sci-fi book, Heavy Weather, author Bruce Sterling depicted life in a climate devastated North America. It included very long-lasting, perhaps permanent, storm zones. Now science fiction becomes meteorological fact with Tropical Cyclone Freddy hitting Mozambique for the second time. Tropical cyclones are known as hurricanes to many of you. Imagine a hurricane like Sandy striking New York and then returning about 2 weeks later to hit it again. That just happened over Mozambique and other East African countries. Freddy is also a worst-case scenario for storm surge as it crawls along the coast at about 1 mile an hour. Dozens of people have been killed, tens of thousands of homes destroyed, and millions of people in several countries became storm refugees. What is happening here? Are these the first signs of the big superstorms James Hansen warned about as the planet heats up? Hurricane, cyclone, typhoon, call it what you want. When it hangs around for a month, battering everything, you have a new kind of trouble. I'm Alex Smith. Let's get to our great guests. These are strange and stressful times. Crisis arrive all at once. War, disease, and extreme weather from a destabilized climate. As Thomas Homer Dixon and Johan Rockström asked in the New York Times, what happens when a cascade of crises collide? I have been recording and interviewing Thomas Homer Dixon since 2008. He is one of the bright minds for the big picture, weaving in geopolitics, security, the environment, and social change. In Canada, Homer Dixon is director and founder of the Cascade Institute at Royal Road University and a research chair at the University of Waterloo. You may know him for his books like The Upside of Down, Catastrophe, Creativity, and the Renewal of Civilization, and The Ingenuity Gap, Can We Solve the Problems of the Future? Let's check in with Thomas on Vancouver Island. Thomas, in recent months we had mass mortality events in Turkey, the Ukraine, and a wave of COVID in China that may have killed a million people. Add in record-smashing typhoons in New Zealand, drought hitting both Argentina, and a winter drought in Europe right now. We can't keep track of it all. Is this the polycrisis you warned about for years?
So the concept polycrisis is a relevant neologism, something that's been coined relatively recently. But the underlying phenomenon itself is something that I've been discussing and talking about, and my research group has been studying for a considerable period of time. The polycrisis label really got its first prominence around 2018 or so in Europe, in the wake of the refugee, financial, and Brexit crises, where people are talking about the conjunction of crises that Europe had weathered, at least it seemed that Europe had weathered them by that point. And then more recently, especially with the work of the Columbia University historian Adam Tooze, the concept's been getting a lot of airtime in his blogs and Substack blogs, and also a lot of conversation at the World Economic Forum as just kind of a general label for the fact that the world seems to be incredibly chaotic, and we're being, as you suggested, hit by one shock after another. A lot of them related, of course, to climate change, but then we've had the pandemic and the financial and economic consequences of the pandemic, food crisis that was aggravated by the pandemic and also by the Ukraine-Russia war and the war itself, of course. And it seems like all of this stuff is happening. I think a lot of the commentators, including those at the World Economic Forum, think of this as just, in a sense, bad luck. You know, just a lot of stuff happens to be going wrong simultaneously, and we'll weather it, we'll move beyond it, and life will get back to something like normal. We're arguing in our work that actually the coincidence of crises is not a coincidence. In other words, there are underlying mechanisms that are driving the synchronization of a lot of these crises that we don't fully understand. So we haven't unpacked the causal dynamics entirely, but it's not just chance that a whole bunch of things are going wrong simultaneously.
That's really interesting. On November 13, 2022, you and the famous Swedish climate scientist Johan Rockström published this piece in the New York Times. It was titled, What Happens When a Cascade of Crises Collide? Is that possible? And could we know what would happen?
That piece in the New York Times was really our research team's contribution to the conversation around the polycrisis. And again, I think we were trying to push that conversation forward to new and productive places. We identified a series of systemic risks. Specialists in this field talk about global systemic risk. They include climate change, financial system instability, democratic decline, biodiversity collapse, energy and food crises, and the like. People, they come up with kind of a standard list of 20 or 25 different things. But what we identified, Johan and I identified in that article in the New York Times, is that not only are these underlying systemic risks amplifying in severity over time, they're getting worse over time. Climate change is getting worse. Biodiversity collapse is getting worse, et cetera. Democratic decline seems to be getting worse. But there's an acceleration in the speed of deterioration. In other words, the increment of warming on an annual basis is getting larger over time. So things are getting worse faster than they were before. And then the most important contribution I think this article made was the emphasis on the synchronization effects. That, you know, as I was just saying, that there's something going on here we don't fully understand in terms of the fact that all this stuff is going wrong simultaneously. There are connections. And we tried to identify some of those connections between the crises. But we really most fundamentally made a call to the world scientific and policymaking community, for us to invest a lot more resources to try to understand what's happening. Because you can't respond if you don't know where your target is, if you don't know what the problem is. What's going on in terms of the feedback loops and synchronization effects among these different problems? That was the intent of the article, is to stimulate more attention to this polycrisis. It's not just a coincidence. It's not just bad luck. Something else is going on.
Just for fun, I went back to a presentation you gave in March 2008 for Toronto EnviroFest. And speaking as the Wall Street banks like Lehman Brothers collapsed, you said, and I quote, "Shocks tend to propagate from one side of the globe to another very quickly, as we are seeing again with the credit crisis or something like SARS," end quote. Well, that certainly aged well. Here we are with countries like Sri Lanka, Pakistan, and Argentina close to bankruptcy, and this time it's SARS-2, which we renamed COVID. Is there a difference now?
Yeah, I think we were seeing, and we have been seeing for quite a while, I mean, even going back to the dot-com implosion and the East Asian financial crisis back in the late 90s, we've been seeing these kinds of teleconnections between crises. And it's something, as you've noted, that I've been talking about for decades. I think it's different now because people are actually palpably aware of the increasing frequency and severity of these shocks. There's a natural desire to try to establish certainty, to have the sense that the future is going to be sort of the same as the past. And if things are going wrong in the present, then you just have to wait or push through and you'll get to a place where you get a kind of return to normal, right? But there's no normal anymore. And in fact, there's probably not going to be any stability in our systems going forward because, well, I mean, when you look at the climate, we're simply pumping too much extra energy into the climate on an annual basis. And one of the figures I use is, you know, there's now an energy imbalance at the surface of the planet of 0.9 watts per square meter. So that means you've basically, because you've changed the transparency of the atmosphere to heat, to infrared radiation with our greenhouse gas emissions, there's more energy coming into the atmosphere ocean system than is going out back into space. And the difference is about 0.9 watts per square meter. So if you add that up across the entire surface of the planet, that's equivalent to about 600,000 Hiroshima-type atomic bombs exploded in the atmosphere every day, right? So we're pumping that energy into the ocean atmospheric system. And that's causing the ocean atmospheric system to become more nonlinear, to move beyond its equilibrium state. So we don't actually know where it's going to go. It's not going to settle down to a new normal. And I think people are starting to recognize intuitively something like this is happening, which terrifies them, as it should. I mean, if you're not terrified, you're not paying attention at this point. I think the difference between 2008, 2009 is we were seeing, for those of us who are observing things, seeing the emergence of these new phenomena, these new kind of teleconnections and instabilities. And we were saying, this is going to get worse, pay attention. And people said, no, we've got the systems, we've got the economic tools, the economic theories and the other theories to manage everything. And those tools weren't working anymore then, and they're certainly not working now. So there's a real palpable sense of intellectual and scientific crisis, I think. And it's one of the things that's driving, frankly, the discrediting of technocratic elites and conventional science around the world, because it looks like folks are just out of their depth, and they are.
And for years, you've been warning that ordinary, well-meaning people need to plan now what to do if a crisis does break the system, whether it's temporarily or for the long term. You say extremists organize in good times and bad, so they're ready to act in a crisis when we're vulnerable. And we could think of January 6, 2021, the insurrection there, for example. What can we do to fend off domination by violent people with extreme views when big changes happen?
This is a really fundamental question. I don't have a clear answer to it. And, you know, my original research going back to my undergraduate days, 45 years ago, I guess, is on conflict and the causes of war and the causes of conflict. And it's something I've studied my whole life. We're creating conditions that, according to well-tested theories of conflict, will produce widespread civil violence, war, massive deaths, potentially. All I would say is that the line between a humane and constructive response to these crises and one where we're at each other's throats is going to depend fundamentally on the degree of social capital and the strength of our sense of common identity. So that means the levels of trust we have between each other, the networks of cooperation that we build within our communities. Part of it is you have to prepare yourselves in terms of your financial security, ideally as best as possible, trying to make sure if your house is vulnerable to fire that you've got appropriate technology, sprinkler systems and things like that. It's lots of practical stuff you can do to protect yourself. But I think in some ways, the more important thing is building community, is working with communities so that we shoulder to shoulder address these challenges as they come forward. And hope against hope that the world as a whole, humanity as a whole, starts getting ahead of some of the underlying drivers like carbon emissions. Because if we don't get control of the underlying things that are driving these problems, changing the opacity of our atmosphere to infrared radiation, for example, if we don't get on top of those problems, we can't adapt our way out. Eventually, any kind of adaptive mechanisms or social capital we build will be overwhelmed. But in the meantime, there's a lot of stuff we can do to extend the time horizon and work together to protect the good things in our societies and to build new approaches, new economic systems, new social systems in response. But here's the last thing I'd say, and this is maybe sounds a bit pie in the sky, but human beings, I'm not a big advocate or adherent of notions of fixed human identity. I think if there's anything that's true about human beings is that we're extraordinarily plastic creatures. We are unbelievably creative in our response to crises, and we're often most creative when the crises are worst. I don't think we have even begun to test ourselves in the face of these challenges, which are unprecedented in the history of the species. Who knows what we're going to come up with? And it's just possible we're going to come up with some very amazing stuff. That's one of the sources of my hope. It's the kind of thing I tell my kids, right?
Well, we're going to talk a lot more about that in your book in just a few minutes, the book Commanding Hope. So you did create quite a stir, Thomas Homer Dixon, in Canada's Globe and Mail newspaper under the headline, American Polity is Cracked and Might Collapse. Canada Must Prepare. Do you still think that's a risk worth worrying about? And what about European countries? Should they be thinking about this quietly too?
Oh, absolutely. Democracy is under siege worldwide. I'm one of those who believes that the fight in Eastern Europe is really fundamentally a fight to protect democracy. You have a profoundly authoritarian, predatory regime attacking a fledgling, emerging democracy in Ukraine. So far, democracies have more or less rallied. I think there's been a broad recognition in the public, the general public in democracies, that there's something very fundamental at stake. But the larger story is a grim one. And I have to say that the latest news about large language module AI, such as chatbots, is an enormous concern to me. You know, it's not going to be long before Russia and China get hold of that technology. And Russia and China are adamantly pursuing the destruction of Western democracy. There's absolutely no question about it. And they will unleash these technological tools on us, generating an absolute tidal wave of disinformation, fake videos, and everything else you can imagine that will be substantially indistinguishable from the real thing because the AI is so good now. I have no idea how we're going to respond to that. We have 18th and early 19th century democratic institutions that are entirely unadapted for the technological environment in which they exist today. And they've allowed us to build, in the arc of human history, remarkably humane societies for the most part. And they're under extraordinary threat now. So yeah, I mean, in the specific case of the United States, I was writing that article in the Globe and Mail. I think Donald Trump has a real shot at the Republican nomination. And if he has a real shot at the Republican nomination, he has a real shot at the presidency. Because people get tired of the incumbent regime, and there might be a crisis with China or an economic contraction or something like that. And you know, he comes within 1 or 2%. Even if he loses the popular vote, he will declare that it's fraudulent. And you have the risk of widespread civil instability in the United States. And a lot of states are passing laws that allow them basically to override the popular vote in their states and send their own legislatively chosen body of electors to Washington for the Electoral College, basically ignoring the popular vote at the state level. You have multiple pathways for a catastrophe, a political catastrophe in the United States in 2024.
So we may not know what the future looks like, but we know some futures to avoid, like crazy heat or gang rule. Do you want to talk to us about those two futures that you write about in your book, the Mad Max scenario or renewable life?
The second one is renew the future, the Mad Max scenario and renew the future. And I, at the end of the book, I try to unpack their internal meanings, what their fundamental commitments to principles would be, ethical principles and otherwise. So the Mad Max worldview is exactly what the term implies, you know, derived from the Mad Max movies, which I think are pretty good representation of kind of dystopian, very violent future with degraded resources where small, almost tribal identity groups are fighting with each other using bits and pieces of sort of legacy technology scattered across the landscape. The key thing there is this is a world in which you have a scarcity mindset where there's a widespread perception that the world is a dangerous place and the only way you can protect yourself is through the exercise of violence and pulling together with other members of your small tribe to defend yourself. For those who are pessimistic about human nature, there's lots of evidence that that's where we go when the going gets tough and when you're in a situation of extreme scarcity. I propose an alternative in the book, which is one where hope in particular plays a very important role, which is grounded in a very clear vision of a better future, a very important role in sustaining a shared identity across larger groups, where they pull together and try to address their problems together. So yes, the world is a dangerous place, but we know that if we work together, we can make it less dangerous for ourselves. And that implies that we have to be tolerant of each other to a certain extent and understand each other's interests and make some tough trade-offs in terms of distribution of resources and power among us. You would say that that's something that human beings don't do very well, but actually we do it very well all the time. People forget that 99.999% of human interactions are basically peaceful and cooperative. We are in extraordinary times, and there could be extraordinary responses at the national and the global level. We've never been so connected together before. We've never had such good scientific understanding of the nature of our challenges before. And it's pretty clear at the global level that we either deal with problems like climate change and emerging zoonotic viral pandemics collectively as a species, or we're all going to suffer. And those who are the wealthiest among us will just experience the consequences of civilizational fragmentation later than the rest of us. Maybe they'll get an extra decade or two. Just enough time to watch everything disintegrate around them. That doesn't sound like a lot of fun. So, you know, that sense of emerging shared fate on this planet, that there's no place to go to get away, is going to be a very palpable motivator for people all over the world. You know, I get asked still, where can I go? People say, where can I go when things start to fall apart? Where can I go to get away from climate change? And I say, well, nowhere. New Zealand's going to burn too. You know, all these people who are building their airstrips and their gated houses down in New Zealand, they expect they're going to bolt to those areas when the going gets rough in Europe or North America. You know, if things really do get rough, there will be hundreds of thousands of people arriving on boats on the coastal areas of New Zealand. And what are you going to do? You're going to take your pilot's family with you. You're going to take your mechanic's family to keep the plane flying. And what are you going to do when you run out of antibiotics and everything else that we depend upon in a modern globalized technological industrial society. So the idea that somehow you can escape from this now is just nonsense. It's craziness. So that puts us in a situation that my guess is sui generis. It's unusual. It's never before existed in human history. So we may start doing things that have never before happened in human history. Good things, perhaps.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
All right, perhaps it's time for hope. You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Canadian risk expert Dr. Thomas Homer Dixon and award-winning author. And now we enter a dark concept that is very unfashionable. Is honest hope still possible, Thomas?
No, that's a very good question. So in my book, Commanding Hope, I start from the premise that hope is essential, that if we lose hope, then we lose our sense of agency and our possibility for making things better. And we're almost guaranteed to get some version of the worst outcomes that we can imagine. But I also say that most hope that is promulgated nowadays, that is bandied around by different actors in the system, is a hope that is dishonest. It sugarcoats the possibilities. It's not honest about the seriousness of the challenges we face, whether climate change or otherwise. And so I spend quite a bit of time trying to reconcile a scientifically grounded understanding of the world that recognizes the seriousness of our challenges with a notion of hope. I call it honest hope. I think it is possible. The kind of hope I propose is not a namby-pamby, sugar-coated form of hope. It's a very muscular hope. It's the kind of hope that you might need in combat, or when you face a possibly terminal disease, or you're in a concentration camp somewhere, where you have some good sense for the odds, but you also recognize that if you just give up, then there is no possibility of anything positive happening, really. It's interesting, you know, I speak to young people a lot, and they sometimes will come up afterwards and say, so what are the chances here? What do you think the odds are of something like a humane civilization existing post-2100 on the planet? Some positive future for us as young people. And I look at them and I say, well, maybe 20%, maybe less. I'm probably exaggerating at 20%. But the interesting thing is their reaction. I could say 10, I could say 5, and I think the reaction would be the same. They look at me and say, okay. And they walk off and they get to work on taking that 20% and trying to make sure that that's the world that they fall within, or bending those probabilities so they can expand that number. There's something else that I think is important. You know, we don't understand the systems around us well enough to know that it's game over. The people who are prepared to give up and say, well, there's nothing that can be done, are fundamentally grounded in what you might call a mechanistic or non-complex understanding of the world. When you understand that the systems we're in are highly complex and they do all kinds of unexpected things, sometimes unexpectedly good things, and sometimes those unexpectedly good things can happen because of relatively small interventions in the system. But we don't understand the system well enough to know that there's no reason for hope. It's what I tell my kids. You happen to live in one of the most exciting times of human history. Everything's on the line here. And we have no adequate understanding of what's happening around us. So there are all kinds of potentially positive possibilities that have yet to be explored. That's what the Cascade Institute that I'm running is about, by the way. It's basically an institute that's designed to find those possibilities in what the complexity science Stuart Kaufman calls the adjacent possible, which is the boundary, but just beyond what we see and recognize as visible and real. Just beyond that area, he calls that the adjacent possible. And that's a place where you have all kinds of combinatorial possibilities, possibilities for novelty that aren't recognized yet, new kinds of combinations of ideas or technologies or normative principles that haven't been tried before. Given that the world global system is under such enormous stress now, one would expect that new things are going to happen. And not all of them are going to be bad. Some of them might be radically good.
We recently had a mental health expert on Radio EcoShock, and she suggested the more we throw facts at people we disagree with, the more entrenched they become. And you talk about approaching people's worldviews instead, if I got that right. It sounds a bit vague. What do you mean?
Well, I think your mental health expert is probably right, okay? Because I think that especially in scary circumstances when people think the world is becoming increasingly dangerous, they tend to hold on to deep assumptions about what makes the world work. And it doesn't matter what kinds of facts you throw at them. it's very unlikely you're going to convince them with facts alone. The form of hope I advocate is a form that is deeply informed by facts and scientific understanding. I'm not naive enough to think that you can just promulgate that and convince others to adopt it just on the basis of rational argument. So I spend a lot of time at the end of the book talking about how we essentially get inside other people's heads and understand how they see the world, what's scaring them, what their fundamental commitments are, what their, what I call hero projects are, what gives meaning to their lives. And then working with those understandings to try to build a future that is both honest, but grounded in their understanding and their interests, a future vision of the world that makes sense to them, given their worldview. That's basically what I mean. So this is what I would call astute hope. This is hope that there are three kinds of hope I advocate, three coupled forms of hope: honest hope, astute hope, and powerful hope. And astute hope is one that is grounded in an understanding of the people you're working with and you have to engage with to build a better world. You need to build their understanding of what possibility is for a better world in a way that respects their or connects as best as possible to their worldviews, their fundamental commitments, ethical and otherwise. So I spend a lot of time basically trying to unpack other people's worldviews. Now, it's not the case that you can do this with everybody. There are just some who are beyond the pale, and you're not going to be able to ultimately engage with them in any productive way. But I think in most cases, and I go through a number of thought experiments where I try to put myself in the mind of, for instance, climate denialists, or I put myself in the mind of what my world would look like if I found out tomorrow that climate change was not a problem. It just shifts everything so radically when you go through these thought experiments. And you recognize that there are still ways of having conversations with these people and ways that we can move forward towards a better world collectively rather than just in isolation. But it has to start by getting inside other people's heads, figuring out whether you can work with them or not. And usually throwing facts at them doesn't work. That's not the place to start. The place to start is understanding how they see the world. So I provide a number of tools, one called state-space modeling, another one called cognitive affective mapping, that people could use to better understand the social circumstances and the worldviews of groups around them so they can be more astute in getting to the world that they're hoping for.
Where can those tools be found?
So they're described in the book, Commanding Hope. There's a chapter on each. There's a chapter 17 is on cognitive affective mapping and 18 is on state space, or maybe 18 and 19. And then there's an actual tool online called Valence that allows people to make cognitive affective maps, or what we call CAMs, C-A-Ms. So these are concept maps, but they're different from standard concept maps. But your listeners will know probably what a concept map is. It's basically you take a bunch of nouns or concepts that are linked together in a way, you know, the concept of house and the concept of furniture and the concept of chair and the concept of people. You can sort of create a little network of the concepts associated with the idea of a house. But the difference with cognitive affective maps is that you actually load the affective valence or value, either positive emotional or negative emotional value, into each of the concepts. So if you feel good about a house, it's surrounded by an oval. If you've got color in your graphical system, it's a green oval. If you feel bad about a house, that's a terrifying place for you. Maybe it's a place where you've been attacked before, then you would surround it with a red hexagon. And what this allows you to do is not just do the concept map, but you actually get a very real and immediate impression of people's emotional reactions to sets of concepts that describe the world. And it's that emotional reaction that you have to be aware of if you want to construct astute hope. You have to understand what's scaring people and what they desire, what they're hopeful about, what they want in the world, what things make them feel good, right? So cognitive affective mapping, we have a tool online called Valence. It's at the Cascade Institute website that allows people to construct their own cognitive affective maps really quickly. We've done it with hundreds and hundreds of people around the world on everything. You know, in Turkey, the conflict within universities over alcohol between Islamicists and secular Turks, in Germany, the people's attitudes towards electric vehicles. Here on Vancouver Island, we've done cognitive affective maps on the conflict over ecological protection in the Cowichan Valley on the island. It's a really provocative tool. When people use it, they see all kinds of things and start thinking about all kinds of things they wouldn't have thought about before.
Well, now that your trilogy on navigating an age of crisis is complete in three books, what are you working on now?
I'm putting all my time into this new institute, the Cascade Institute. It's really an exercise in trying to distill what I've learned over 40 or 45 years and apply it in a very practical way to address these problems. And it's about taking complex systems understandings and using that to find what we call high leverage intervention points. So basically mapping technological systems, belief systems using things like cognitive effective mapping, institutional systems, and all of them together, connecting all of those things together, and looking for places where relatively small interventions can produce a really big difference, what we call high leverage intervention points, or HLIPs. And we have a number of projects underway, one on geothermal power, another one on the polycrisis, which are looking at ways of stimulating positive change, leveraging the nonlinearity, the fact that these systems around us that we're embedded in now can sometimes respond to relatively small interventions in really dramatic ways. You have to know how the system works well to find those opportunities. So there are a number of groups around the world. I'd say there's probably about half a dozen that are doing this kind of work, and we're right there at the forefront. And we're the leading organization in Canada doing this at the moment.
From Royal Road University, we have been speaking with Thomas Homer Dixon, award-winning author of The Ingenuity Gap, Upside of Down, and now Commanding Hope. You can find out a lot more at his website, www.homerdixon.com. I will also add links and notes in my own show blog, ecoshock.org. Thomas, it's been great talking with you. Please come again.
Thank you so much. It's been terrific.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Are you tired of treading carefully around the fragile tempers of fossil fuel apologists? Here comes a fresh voice with climate truth that gets a little too close to all of us. This February, Yogi Henlon did it with his biting article, Fossil Fragility, published at resilience.org. Educated in California, London, and Kiel, Germany, Henlon is an environmental philosopher, political theorist, and public health scientist. He is assistant professor at the Erasmus School of Philosophy in Rotterdam, Netherlands. Dr. Henlon still maintains research links with the University of California. From Rotterdam, Yogi Henlon, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much for having me, Alex.
As we speak, Europe is experiencing its second winter drought in a row following record-smashing heat last summer. Key rivers are low again, as is snow on the Alps. Everybody can see it. But are people around you ready to get off fossil fuels right away?
No, they're not. And I'll explain why. We have a pandemic of comfortability. We're just so inured into a certain system of thinking that somebody else will do it, that either the government or the market will do the work that we would otherwise need to do by ourselves. And while I do think that each one of us has a responsibility to be part of the solution, a lot of my message gets beyond this idea of individual heroics, because as we know historically from the documents of the fossil fuel and many other industries, individual responsibility rather than taking responsibility, extended producer responsibility, for one's own manufacturing and production processes, let alone having our governments actually govern, is where we are suffering the most right now and where we really need to have leadership in order to change the defaults, which nudge us in easily ecological directions rather than making it a heroic uphill battle.
You talk about soft climate change denialists. I'm not sure what you mean by that. And how do you try to help them without triggering your own negative emotions?
That's a great question, because emotions obviously are sort of the Gordian knot at the center of what we're dealing with here. On the one hand, you could say we have people like you and me who are trying to do everything we can. We're in an ecological climate emergency. And so there's a tendency with that sort of emergency thinking to also get caught up sometimes in our fight, flight, or freeze mechanism, which makes us easy prey, you could say, for a dualistic or polarized political discourse, right, where we are caught up ourselves without meaning to be in this dehumanizing finger-pointing circle, right? And what that does in some ways, I believe, is it further pushes away the possibility of those actors who are soft or hard denialists. And I would say we are all soft denialists from a certain perspective in various degrees. And so I think that the ecologically saintly and the ecological sinners, when we place it in that sort of terms, that religious terms, it makes it too easy to forget that we really do rely on every single one of us to make this great transition towards ecological and social justice that we're absolutely needing right now.
And on the plus side, you say wrestling with people who choose misinformation or just no information has actually made you stronger.
Absolutely. I see in here in the Netherlands, as well as I've seen in California, that even well-meaning people who you could say have through maybe no fault of their own been enculturated into a certain ideology that these businesses that are making record profits, the fossil fuel companies, that they are part of the solution, that they're well-meaning. And so I think that when we work with that perspective, we can sort of dissect some of the emotional, you could say, hooks that we all have in various ways, and in which we can look at the ways in which, for example, we all use fossil fuels and can be grateful for them and be really, really grateful for the light and the internet and, you know, the things that allow us to live our lives, and also sort of say a requiem, have a grieving process for the death of these industries, but have it be a sort of celebration of life. They served us well, and now it's time to move on.
You were in Europe this winter. You experienced firsthand the panic as Russian gas ended and household energy bills rose through the roof. And that panic led Western governments, the same ones who made grand statements about fighting climate change just, you know, at the previous COP, they approved extra fossil fuel expansion and new ports for natural gas for Germany, and just all to keep the lights on and to keep people from freezing to death, they said. How can you argue against that?
Yes, it's a very complex situation that we have here. The energy prices indeed quadrupled here in the Netherlands for natural gas. And I have a project with some students at Erasmus University looking at energy poverty in our city and how those habitants who have the least resources to pay for energy oftentimes have the least insulated homes. Their landlords don't want to pay for, say, heat pumps or the technologies that rich people can already have installed and thus be financially buffered from these energy changes. The truth is, Alex, is that, yes, of course there's been a war, but, you know, the actual flow of gas has not changed at all. The problem that's driving up the prices, unfortunately, you know, for all the war, for all the horror which is going on in Europe with the invasion of Ukraine, what we are dealing with is speculation. We're dealing with price fluctuations based on futures markets. We're not actually dealing with one iota of diminished gas flow. So we're really looking here at just the profits of a fossil fuel industry that, you know, it's a dinosaur and should be obsolete by now. And Europe has had so many chances to get it right, to move on, to get energy independence and security. And they have, in many ways, missed many of those opportunities, which at this point, we see clearly that there are added benefits of doing the right ecological thing, because it stabilizes your energy markets, keeps it so that poor people don't have to choose to heat or to eat.
Is it a stretch to blame climate inaction on racism?
I do think that because of the colonial history of energy, power, and policy, that racism plays a large role. I would also say that classism, sexism, ageism equally are parts of how we have created a society where we believe that it's okay to hoard resources over here while denying them to other people over there, and then saying that people in poorer countries or that people who have been marginalized are using too much or doing too much when they want the same lifestyle that we are, that's being advertised them at their cost through all of these marketing channels and social media.
Your article in resilience.org also points to Rose Abramoff, one of too many American climate and environmental scientists who were fired or defunded or chased away, and not just in Trump times, but going back to two decades of oil-loving Bush administrations. It may be part of a longer history of anti-intellectualism in American life, and that Pulitzer Prize-winning book by Richard Hofstadter is still required reading, by the way. Is Erasmus University in Rotterdam publicly funded? Is the climate for truth tellers and personal action better there in the Netherlands?
I would say that it's better in general than the U.S. in general, but because we are originally a business school at the Erasmus University of Rotterdam, that we have deep, long-lasting relationships with what was formerly Royal Dutch and now just Shell, since they moved their headquarters from the Netherlands to the UK after a judgment in The Hague saying that they would be required to reduce their CO2 output by 25%. And so what we see is in the Netherlands, there's a lot of goodwill, there's a lot of funds, but the question on the table for us at the moment of, for example, divesting in fossil fuels, from divesting from those firms that are most responsible for climate change, hasn't broken through yet. We have ABP, one of the biggest pension funds in the world, and after a 10-15 year campaign, ABP finally started divesting from fossil fuels. But we don't even know at this point all of the relationships between the professors at our university and the fossil fuel industry. We are publicly funded. However, we get a decent amount of revenue from private industry because, like it in the US, the Netherlands does not have a firewall between the funding of science by industry and independent funding. We could do that. We could say, hey, we're going to have a science tax on all transnational companies, and 2-3% of your profits will be going into doing research and development, making sure that your products are safe, looking at questions that are socially relevant. This is the problem of philanthropy, right? When you have an interested party setting research agendas and grant money is made available in order to study questions that they are interested in, you are not necessarily going to always get science for the public good.
I just have to read this wonderful paragraph from your article at resilience.org. Part of the problem is tone policing. When climate activists protest for a democratic and science-based government, they are derided as being too shrill, doomerist, or snowflakes. Yet when fossil fuel industry apologists get their panties in a twist about converting from gas to electric stoves, they are seen as traditionalists defending the sacred values of industry propagandized home cooking, end quote. So in addition to your other roles, and including editing a journal, which we may get to, you're obviously a writer. What else have you published, Yogi?
I've published an article with a Nautilus looking at the largest electric battery recycler in the U.S. and how he was put in jail by Microsoft for copyright infringement when, in fact, he was taking old machines from, for example, American Airlines and refurbishing them usually for old folks so that they could have really inexpensive and reliable computer. I've also written at The Conversation on the environmental harms of e-cigarettes, which I've done quite a bit of study on. We moved from conventional cigarettes to e-cigarettes because, you know, the industry is feeling the heat and they're trying to addict another generation with tobacco. But unfortunately, nobody has done their due diligence as to the environmental impact of having these lithium ion batteries, these heavy metals and electronic components and plastics being littered all over our planet. Because we know that with cigarettes, for example, it's estimated that 2/3 of all cigarette butts are littered. And with e-cigarettes, we don't have the numbers yet, but we have, in my research, looked at high school campuses in California and shown that we have found many littered and maybe forgotten or lost e-cigarettes on high school campuses. So that this is yet another part of the technologization of our products, but not thinking through the full circular economy. We haven't thought cradle to grave. Instead, you know, people are just trying to make a buck.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. Ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, talking with environmental philosopher and public health researcher, Dr. Yogi Hendlin. We are talking about the dangerous psychological terrain as fossil fuel lovers fight a rearguard action of resistance. Yogi, you talk about extractivism. What do you mean?
Well, I think extractivism goes back thousands of years. If you look at Roman times, the invention of money in the current way that we have it was in silver, paid to mercenaries, which had to colonize more and more land to get more and more silver mines to pay the mercenaries, and that farmers had to begin paying their taxes, not in crops, but in silver, so that the mercenaries from the government, the military, would have something that they could buy with their coins, with their silver pieces. And so I follow the work of Fabian Scheidler in his book, The End of the Mega Machine, which looks at Lewis Mumford's notion of the mega machine as being not just industry, not just government, but the marriage of sort of the monopoly on violence of the government with the ability to mine and make things that give you increased power. Historically, it was military power. Now it's technological and biotechnological power over and against any possible opponents or adversaries. And so when I talk about extractivism, I'm talking about how we've moved historically from taking from the land, taking from people in ways that were sustainable to ways that have become not only unsustainable, but we need to start colonizing more and more parts of reality in order to sustain the infinite growth. Because extractivism has no limits. And that's, I think, one of the principal problems that we're bumping up against, because you know, you can't privatize air without undermining air. You can't privatize water without undermining the flows and the abundance of water. So every time we try to extract value from the ecosystem or people, it undermines the very basis of our commons, including, I would say, what I call our epistemic commons. When we talk about words that, for example, when industry research creates false debates, false dissensus over climate change, or false dissensus over how bad glyphosate, PFAS, you know, historically DDT, or any of these other agrochemicals are. What we're looking at is the erosion of public trust in government through the bastardization of science and the scientific enterprise. And that is also a form of extractivism, because it's drawing down on the good name of scientists and of science in order to continue unsustainable policies and to ward off regulations a little bit longer so that more money could be made in the short term.
Remember when oil and gas multinational BP claims that no longer stands for British Petroleum but Beyond Petroleum? And like all the majors, they soon dropped their tiny renewable and recycling programs and went back to pumping more carbon into the atmosphere. That's where the billions of bucks are. And like a bad relationship, we took them back. How was our game with climate killing like an abusive relationship?
our relationship with the companies that have given us the goods of modernity, but have done so at tremendous cost, that until relatively recently, most of us were satisfied to turn a blind eye to. Absolutely, I would say, like an abusive domestic relationship, in the sense that we are making excuses for these companies. We are trying to defend them because we do value, in a sense, what we have gotten from them, and we feel some sort of loyalty that we must not just drop them or say that, you know, they no longer have a place in our society. And I think here, this is exactly where the concept of corporate personhood gets in the way. Because on the one hand, we're happy to have these corporations have the rights of a person in terms of contributing money to campaigns and, you know, having certain rights to sue governments over losses, as we've seen in the Rockhopper case in Italy, for example. These are corporations that if you make a environmental policy that prevents them from further destroying public health and the environment, will attempt to sue your government for hundreds of millions, if not billions, in order to try to regress environmental policy rather than abide by it, right? So the whole notion of CSR, right, corporate social responsibility, well, I think some people really had genuine high hopes at the beginning. It's become quite clear that this is another form of our addiction. It's another way of us saying, but look at all the other good things that they're doing. They couldn't be all bad. And at the same time, they are beating our climate into a pulp to the point where we, as you said, are experiencing here in Europe some of the driest records ever. You know, I know, for example, people start getting concerned when they can't ski anymore, which has happened. But really, this is far down the pipeline. Like with many things, I like to say, with William Gibson, the future is already here. It's just not evenly distributed. If we were putting enough attention on all the climate catastrophes and the trillions worldwide in costs, humanitarian, but also in crops, also in water and infrastructure, the extreme weather events and having our climate and seasons go out of whack, this very soon is going to become a dire circumstance in terms of feeding the planet. When you don't have stable seasons, it becomes impossible to grow crops. And so this is a very fundamental aspect of our reality. And yet, like an abusive relationship, we have attempted to just hark on the virtues and all the good things of the relationship while ignoring the abuse.
That article, Fossil Fragility, was published at resilience.org. But Yogi, your bio stimulated another new search for me and possibly for our listeners. You are editor-in-chief of the journal Biosemiotics. I had to look it up. What is biosemiotics?
Biosemiotics is looking at how all living beings, from humans to our primate ancestors, to cetaceans and fungi and plants and amoebas and bacteria and even down to viruses, make meaning in the world. Semiotics is the study of signs or significance, how meaning is made according to the very different realities that all of these organisms inhabit. For me, I focus on the interspecies way in which meaning is made. For example, if you follow the extended evolutionary synthesis, which has sort of eclipsed the modern synthesis in evolutionary biology, sometimes called eco-evo-devo, you can see that the holobiont, right, in and on our bodies are hundreds, if not thousands, of different bacteria, fungi, protists, nematodes, etc., many of which we could not live without. So in a sense, we are interspecies all the way down. And the idea that we could hurt part of our ecosystem or a habitat without that hurting us comes, I would say, from a false notion of how biology works and a false notion of reality, because we are porous beings and we are so much more delicate than we've ever known before. And this is how my work in biosemiotics and public health come together, the hottest trend in public health at the moment is what we call planetary health, right? How the health of the planet affects the health of people. And I find that my research in biosemiotics reinforces the research program of planetary health because it really shows on a minute and, you could say, case-based level how dependent we are on the health of, say, our mitochondria on the inside of our bodies or trees around us. We know that areas, urban areas that have trees controlling for all other variables that we could possibly think of, have 15 to 20% less crime. There are certain evolutionarily adapt instincts and anthropological effects that we as human animals can really grow to learn from and realize that our interaction on a biological, ecological, physical level with an intact living ecosystem is not a nice thing to have. It's not optional. It's actually required for mental health and physical well-being.
Let's take a flyer into a future where most systems are managed by artificial intelligence. AI would run everything from financial systems to production and shipping of consumer goods, even providing maybe virtual relationships. What if a powerful AI system starts putting new signals into nature, a kind of artificial biosemiotics? Is anybody looking into that possibility?
Yeah, and I mean, we've already seen this with the rise of air pollution and light pollution. Light pollution, I can briefly talk about. A lot of our nighttime cityscapes have light on the blue end of the spectrum. And what that does is it hurts animals and plants and trees, and so they can't really sleep. Just like us, blue light wakes us and plants up, whereas red light, light that's warmer on the spectrum, helps put us to sleep. And so we've already been, without the help or need of artificial intelligence even, we have already been artificially hacking into the systems of our ecologies. But I would say that the effects have been harmful, not just for trees and all the other organisms that rely on darkness or on being free from this light pollution, but also on ourselves. And there are thousands of studies detailing, chronicling the harms from this. My takeaway with AI and with our own knowledge of how ecosystems work is that even the most advanced knowledge is always articulating an N-1 system. We were created by a system. We emerge from a system which we did not create, which means that we can never fully understand the system. So the moment we try to have a artificial habitat, we wind up with, you know, biosphere, right? Biosphere 2, these famous experiments that are famous because they failed, that they were not able to reproduce a healthy, living, artificial biosphere because they didn't know how to do it. They didn't have all the components. Even with all the king's horses and all the king's men, they could not put Humpty together again.
We have been talking with Yogi Henlon, a California environmental philosopher and public health scientist, transplanted to Erasmus University in Rotterdam. You can find links to follow up on this discussion in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Yogi, you brightened my day with some truth-telling. Thank you.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. That's it for this show. Check out all our past programs free at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening, and let's meet up again next week.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness, Feminist Theology and Women in the Muslim World. Dr. Rifat Hassan is a Muslim theologian from Pakistan. She says that since anti-woman legislation and custom are enacted in the name of theology, it is necessary to study the Quran and critique the source.
On the basis of my years of study of the Quran, I see as a document which guarantees human freedom and equality. And there is nothing that I see in the Quran which in any way discriminates against women. The interpretation of the Quran has been very heavily influenced by the Hadith literature. In other words, the Hadith literature is the lens through which the Quran itself has been read and translated. So unless we take cognizance of this fact and deal with the Hadith literature, it's very difficult for a lot of people to go back and look at the Quran with fresh eyes. On the basis of the Quran, focusing on the question of creation, there is no difference between the creation of men and women. God created man and woman at the same time in like manner of the same substance. Total equality. On the other hand, this is not what has been believed historically or in the Islamic tradition, and I've referred you to what I believe is the source of it, which is the Hadith literature.
Last week, you heard how the women's movement in Pakistan asked for her help as early as 1984. They organized in response to the first introduction of anti-women Islamic law in the late 1970s. Rifat Hassan said that this request changed her life. In part one, you heard her fascinating retelling of the story of Adam and Eve, a story that is shared in Islam, Judaism, and Christianity. In the original text, women are neither inferior nor sinful. Adam is not a man's name. It is the word for human. In fact, in the Quran, the original being created by God is feminine, a fact that is concealed in all translations. Another factor came into play that changed the equal standing of women in the Quran. Rifat Hassan says that today we see the Quran through the lens of later writings, the so-called hadiths. These are quotes attributed to the Prophet Muhammad and passed on, not by the Prophet, but by people who say they heard him tell the story. And it is here, and only here, in the hadiths, that the story of the creation of woman from the rib is told six times. Here is Dr. Rifat Hassan analyzing the six versions of the rib story. That story is used to depict women as inferior, secondary, and even crooked. Rifat Hassan.
If you analyze the content of these hadiths, the following points emerge. One, woman is created from a rib or is like a rib. Two, the most curved or crooked part of the rib is its top. Number three, the crookedness of the rib and of the woman is irremediable. Any effort to remove it will result in breakage. And four, in view of the above, an attitude of kindness is recommended, and those who wish to benefit from women are advised to do so, quote, while crookedness remains in her. There is obviously a connection between these hadiths and the rib story in Genesis. But there are also changes. For example, this rib is not the rib of Adam. There is no mention of Adam in any of these hadiths. This is a disembodied rib. This is a sort of rib you could buy in a grocery store. It could be anybody's rib or anything's rib. Secondly, there is an emphasis on the crookedness of the rib, whatever that means. Then there is this idea that you should not try to do anything about this crookedness. Now, you know, you wonder when you look at these hadiths as to what they mean. I mean, why? What is the meaning of exhorting people to be kind to women because they are irremediably crooked? What does crookedness mean? Is it some sort of a handicap? Now, if it's a physical handicap, and certainly one should be compassionate toward people with physical handicaps, then why should one not try to do something about it? Perhaps the handicap can be eliminated. If it's a moral handicap or an intellectual handicap, then if women are intellectually and morally deficient, then why should people be kind to them? You know, there are certain logical problems here when you try to interpret these hadiths. You know, when I first found these hadiths, being Western trained, my first impulse was to do content analysis, and I didn't find that very hard at all, because there is one law of hermeneutics, of interpretation, which every Muslim scholar accepts, And that is that if any hadith or any number of hadiths are found to be in contradiction to the Quran, you must reject them. The Quran cannot be overturned by a hadith or by a million hadiths. That is a law of interpretation accepted by all Muslim scholars. And therefore, it seemed to me that since all of these hadiths were clearly in contradiction to the Quranic statements about human creation, none of which mentioned the rib or the crookedness of the rib or any such thing, that it would be just very simple to reject these hadiths. But when I did my analysis, content analysis, in which I showed, in which I demonstrated pretty compellingly that these hadiths were clearly in contradiction to Quranic statements about creation, I was told by Muslim scholars that this was not acceptable. This methodology was not acceptable because the only way that you can reject the hadith is if you show there is some problem with the isnad. Now, fortunately for us, we can still do that in the case of a number of hadiths, because at the same time, in the second and third century of Islam, when the hadiths were being compiled, they were also being compiled encyclopedic works about the transmitters of hadith. So we have these huge books which have information about virtually every person who has narrated a hadith. And so it is possible to go back and rediscover, get some information about these people who are mentioned as narrators of these hadiths. And I discovered that it is possible to argue that there were weaknesses in the isnad. The companion mentioned as the initial narrator of all of these six hadiths is a companion known to us as Abu Huraira. Now, Abu Huraira was a very controversial person during his lifetime. He did not spend a very long time with the Prophet, but he narrated a very large number of hadiths, and it was a kind of, there was a sort of an attitude of fun that other companions had toward him, because whenever they would see him coming, they would say, now comes Abu Huraira, let's see what hadith he's going to tell us about now. Now, I became very interested in learning something about him, and I started, again, being Western trained, I started by looking at the Encyclopedia of Islam. I read the article on Abu Huraira. And I found in that article, it stated in that article that Abu Huraira was a very controversial companion, and his credibility was often questioned by his contemporaries. And I said, well, that's good. I found some material here that's important. But then, of course, I learned very soon in discourse with other Muslim scholars that it is not possible today for a Muslim scholar to quote the Encyclopedia of Islam. Because guess where the Encyclopedia of Islam is published? It's published in the Netherlands by Leiden Press, E.J. Brill, which is the hotbed of Christian missionaries. So you cannot quote a Christian missionary author against a companion of the Prophet. So that won't work. So I looked for an Islamic source. One source that I found was an 8th century Mu'tazilite philosopher by the name of Nazam. And quoting from Nazam, Nazam said, he said, I reject the entire canon of hadith on account of Abu Huraira. He was the worst of liars. Now, that's a very strong statement. But of course, how could anyone accept the word of a Mu'tazilite philosopher against that of a companion of the Prophet? I mean, it's absolutely impossible. So then the difficulty is, what kind of source are you going to use? Well, I was able to find one source which I think can be used because of its credibility. The source is Imam Abu Hanifa, who is the founder of the Hanafi school, which is the largest school of Islamic law, who in general did not accept many hadiths in his school of law, but he, in one place, talks about three companions whose hadiths he was not willing to accept, and one of them was Abu Huraira. In fact, he names him first. Now, I want to point out to you the seriousness of the situation here, because up till this point in time, it has not been possible to raise any critical question about the companions of the Prophet. It's, as Goldziher has pointed out, it's a capital crime to question any companion. It's a capital crime. Now, the problem is further compounded by the fact that there is no clear definition of who is a companion. Now, there are some companions of the Prophet that we are very sure about. We know about them because they spent their whole lifetime with the Prophet and they are very well-known and well-respected figures. But the list of companions is a very long list, and there are many people who are listed amongst the companions who may have spent a very short time with the Prophet, about whom we really don't know very much at all, but somehow they have become subsumed under this general category. So this is another area in which very little work has been done to determine in a precise or exact way who is a companion. Another important point here is that it's a consensus of Islamic scholars that the great majority of hadiths were fabricated. This was, of course, the consensus of Bukhari and Muslims themselves. Imam Muslim examined more than 600,000 hadiths and accepted less than 3,000 of them as authentic. So he rejected the vast majority of the hadiths as inauthentic. So the question of, you know, the authenticity of the hadith is a very important question. Now, when we look at a hadith and we say it's inauthentic, what is being said is that the inauthenticity could relate to the matn, to the content, or to the isnad. So while on the one hand we can raise all these critical questions about Abu Huraira in the context of these traditions that I have mentioned, but one can also say, how can we be absolutely sure that Abu Huraira narrated any of these traditions? Because, you know, if you can fabricate the content of a hadith, you can also fabricate the isnad of a hadith. I am mentioning these points to you in order to illustrate to you the great difficulty of studying this body of material. But it is in this body of material, I am quite sure about this point, that the attitudes of the Muslims, particularly their negative attitudes towards women, are rooted much more in the hadith literature than in the Quran. Because the Quran, on the basis of my years of study of the Quran, I see as a document which guarantees human freedom and equality. And there is nothing that I see in the Quran which in any way discriminates against women. The way that the Quran has been interpreted, the interpretation of the Quran has been very heavily influenced by the hadith literature. In other words, the hadith literature is the lens through which the Quran itself has been read and translated and interpreted. So unless we take cognizance of this fact and deal with the hadith literature, it's very difficult for a lot of people to go back and look at the Quran with fresh eyes. Okay, so what's my conclusion? Well, my conclusion is as follows. On the basis of the Quran, focusing on the question of creation, there is no difference between the creation of men and women. God created man and woman at the same time in like manner of the same substance. Total equality. On the other hand, this is not what has been believed historically or in the Islamic tradition, and I have referred you to what I believe is the source of it, which is the hadith literature. Now, on the basis of my research, on the basis of both my content analysis as well as my analysis of the isnad, I show in my work that the hadiths should be and must be rejected because they do contradict the Quran and they are also formally weak, that we can show problems in the isnad itself. Okay, this issue is so important because if God created man and woman equal, and God is the giver of ultimate value, if God created man and woman equal, then if they subsequently become unequal in human society, which they have become in virtually all human societies, this cannot be in accordance with the will of God, because God created them equal. If, on the other hand, God did not create man and woman equal, as is believed by the majority of the people in our traditions, then trying to make them equal, as these perverse feminists are trying to do, is something which is subverting the plans of God. So then this is the fundamental question. Did God create man and woman equal or not equal? On the basis of my study, I have no hesitation whatsoever in saying that God, in fact, did create man and woman equal, and that therefore any kind of inequality that exists is a manifest sign of injustice, not only towards human beings, but in a sense, it's an act of disobedience toward God. Now, my final question, which is addressed to activists, because I consider myself a human rights activist, and I do my scholarship, I do my studying, because I hope and believe that this study is necessary in order to liberate human beings, that it's going to make a difference to people's lives. In that context, I want to say the following. I want to refer you to something that one of my teachers once said to me. He was a Muslim man, scholar, who had studied the Quran for many years. And he said to me once, he said, you know, supposing you are traveling on a train, and at some point the train gets derailed, gets off the proper track and starts going in some other direction, and you realize after a while that you've gone 20 miles off track. You cannot at that point switch tracks. What you have to do first is you have to go back to the point of origin, where you got derailed, and then get on the right track. Okay? The same point was made by the philosopher Santayana, who said, those who do not know their history are destined to repeat it. Women need to know the point at which they got derailed, and we got derailed at the very beginning. So we need to get back to the point of origin and then get on the proper track. That's the only way that we are ever going to be liberated. There is no other way. Thank you.
That was Dr. Rifat Hassan, feminist, Muslim theologian, and human rights activist from Pakistan. She had time for an interview, and the following day, we met at UC Berkeley. I wanted to know more about the common story that women share in all three religions. Rifat Hassan.
I think that there are many things in common to these three traditions. They have a common theological framework. They are all patriarchal. They are monotheistic. They believe in prophets and sacred texts and accountability for actions and so on. I think they also share the myths which oppress them. You know, the myth that Adam was God's primary creation and Eve was created out of the rib of Adam, so as derivative and secondary, that she was responsible for the fall and she was created not only from him but for him. I think this is a myth that is shared by all three religions and has been very detrimental to women's position. I think that when Jewish, Christian, and Muslim women begin to engage in dialogue with each other and begin to study their text together and begin to realize that they share the roots of their bondage and their exploitation, that there are many avenues emerge in which they can work together. Once people become knowledgeable, women begin to see this, they can cooperate. But unfortunately, there are so few opportunities at this point of bringing Jewish, Muslim, and Christian women together. It's kind of strange because in the context of the ecumenical movement, you know, there's a lot of dialogue going on between Jews, Christians, and Muslims in many places, and it's increasing. But like the rest of the ecumenical movement, it focuses so little on women's issues. So I really think that the time has come for Jewish, Christian, and Muslim women to take the matter in their own hands and to make their own groups, discussion groups, because I think that at the heart of these traditions lies the idea of justice. And if they can work with that to attain justice for each other, and I think that women traditionally and intuitively and elementally work better together than men and are peacemakers. And that it's possible that if women start working together that they may be able to find solution not only to women's issues but to world issues, you know, such as peace and justice and hunger and so many other things.
It's actually interesting meeting you because you take the religion in which you were raised very seriously. And I was raised Christian and I thought all I needed to do was deny its existence and step out of it into a secular world. Mm-hmm. But I find now the secular world does not give an explanation of patriarchy. Mm-hmm. And it only offers what you very interestingly criticized, mm-hmm. equality with mm-hmm. what?
Mm-hmm. You know, I meet a lot of people who make the statement, well, you know, I come from a Christian background or Jewish background, but I'm not really religious. And I always say to them, religion is not just doctrine or dogma. You might have rejected the doctrine or dogma of your religion, But religion has to do with the way that you see the whole world. Religion has so many dimensions, ethical, social, mythological, ritual, etc. And nobody is without religion of some sort. You know, you may consciously deny it, but that's where your consciousness is rooted. Therefore, in a way, you have to deal with it. As far back as we can go in human history, people were never without religion or some sort of religious consciousness. And I frequently get asked this question, you know, why do you, it's so difficult for you to be a Muslim woman because there's so much hostility, so much resistance to the sort of work that you're doing. Isn't it just simply easier to walk away from it and be free of it? And my answer to that is that I'm very concerned about the situation of Muslim women. And I know that women, Muslim women, are so devout and so religious that for them the only way to freedom lies within the tradition and not outside of the tradition. That if I want to be able to be of any service to them at all, I have to work within the tradition. So it's not only for religious or spiritual or theological reasons, but for practical reasons as well, that if you want to be effective, you have to learn to work within the tradition. Each tradition has something of value in it. It also has elements in it that are outmoded and they need to be critiqued. I don't think that any tradition should be deified and idolized. But I also do not think that one can just take a tradition and throw it out of the window without any kind of critical examination of what is of value in it. We all come from a tradition and that we need to be conversant with it, and we need in some way to try to redeem it to whatever extent we can and not reject it out of hand. And you're right, I do take my tradition very seriously, and I think that's why my work has relevance to people, or people find it relevant to their lives.
One small question I wanted to ask you out of personal interest. When I started rereading the story of Adam and Eve, I actually thought I should take pride in the fact that Eve brought up the question of consciousness, and that as women we could really be proud about that step. Is there any theological backing?
Yes, absolutely. You find theological backing for that, I think, in the work of recent theologians in these traditions. For instance, Phyllis Trible, who is a very important Christian theologian, works with textual analysis, interprets the story of the fall, so-called fall, and she says the serpent addressed the woman because, in a sense, she was the leader of the two. And in seizing the initiative and conducting the dialogue, she proved that, you know, she was the one with the discernment and she was the one with the decision. Of course, the interesting thing is that, as most people think, you know, this story is in chapter 3 of Genesis. Most people think that when Eve was having this dialogue with the serpent, Adam was far away and did not participate in it. But the fact of the matter is that Adam was with her. As you know, the new translations say that. There's a word called ima in the Hebrew text, which means that when he was with her, and that was omitted from translations of that story for hundreds of years. So people got the impression that she was alone when she talked with the serpent. But Adam was with her all the time. So it's not that, but he was silent. And that, I think, puts a whole new complexion on the story. But to answer your question in another way, also, for instance, in the Islamic tradition, there is no fall at all. Because according to the Quran, Adam was always meant for the earth. He was from the earth and meant for the earth. And so what you call the fall is, in fact, a state of transition from paradise to the earth. It's sort of like this: when we are in a state of infancy, we are in paradise because we are protected. And then when we reach the point where we can start exercising freedom of will, which is what Eve does at that point, she exercises a freedom of will, then we come of age, we become reach maturity, and then we are able to be God's representatives on earth. And so it so happens that the first act of freedom, of free will, of the human beings was one of disobedience. They disobeyed God. But nonetheless, it was still an act which represented freedom of choice. And when God gave human beings the right to choice, free choice, God took a risk but the Almighty was willing to take it. And there is no suggestion in the Quranic text that God is angry with the two. They admit that they were wrong and they ask God's forgiveness and God forgives them. You know, there is not no fall really, there's just a transition. So I think you're right. I think she does something which brings knowledge. So she is the pioneer. And I think it is something to be proud of. I think that the story of the fall has been grossly, grossly misrepresented and misunderstood. It has quite a different meaning from what people attach to it. Just like the story of creation, I think it meant something different from the way it got interpreted in the context of a very patriarchal, very biased culture. These myths are now being reinterpreted. I think almost re-revealed, in a sense. And I think it's going to have a wonderful impact on women's perceptions of themselves in the future.
That was an interview of feminist theologian Dr. Rifat Hassan. We met in the guest house of the University of California, Berkeley, with the clock of the campanile chiming in the background. She had agreed to see me after her April 1993 talk, Feminist Theology and Women in the Muslim World. This talk had been given in the spirit of peace and justice and to support a common bond among women of the three patriarchal religions of the world, Islam, Christianity, and Judaism. Rifat Hassan has since retired after 33 years of teaching in the U.S. She gave courses not only in theology, but also in literary criticism, Shakespeare, romantic poets, international relations, and foreign policy. However, through all her academic accomplishments, and to this day, she was and is a human rights activist on behalf of women. Rifat Hassan was professor of religious studies and humanities at the University of Louisville, Kentucky. She received her PhD from Durham University, UK in 1968 and has taught in many institutions, including Oklahoma State University and Harvard Divinity School. This was a rare TUC Radio Archive recording brought back for International Women's Month. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under Newest Programs. Time of Useful Consciousness is an aeronautical term. It's the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for useful projects to rescue the planet and the plane. My name is Maria Gelaiden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.